Last week on the show, we reported from the RHA Gallery in Dublin, where their annual exhibition opened recently. The exhibition, you may well know, is one of the most prestigious in the Irish artistic calendar. The works featured comprise invited artists, members of the RHA, and artists of all kinds who respond to an open call to submit their work. During our broadcast, we tweeted a collection of images that we featured in our report from the exhibition. And this year, for the first time, the gallery decided to include a work generated by artificial intelligence. The image, entitled Throwback Selfies Magdalene, generated comment and criticism both for its subject matter and for the fact that it was AI generated in the first place. Abigail O'Brien is the president of the RHA, an artist herself, and also served as chair of the six-person selection panel, and delighted that Abigail has joined us this evening. There are two main strands to the argument here, Abigail. First of all, the fact that this image is AI generated. And secondly, then, the subject matter where the opinion has been expressed that it was treated disrespectfully. Let's start with the AI side of things, the artificial intelligence side of things. The exhibition is open to artists, professionals, amateurs, but there are those that argue that artificial intelligence is the outright enemy of art and aims to replace artists. Is that a concern? Before we get into the specifics of this piece, is that a concern that you've heard before and that is one of your own concerns?
Hi, good evening, Sean. It's not a concern of mine. I think that artists will always find ways of making their point of view visible. And I'm sure it's something that we have to talk about, and there will be arguments on both sides. But I really think that fear is a black hole. And people have feared things in the past about, you know, art-making practices that really haven't had the detrimental effect that people described them having at the time.
So 4,700 submissions to the exhibition this year that you had to whittle down to 380. Tell us a little bit about the selection process there.
Yeah, it was a two-week-long process. We six of us meet and we stay together while we select the works. Initially, it's done digitally, and and as you can imagine, the conversation is mighty in terms of who wants the piece in and who doesn't think it's valid. It's a very tough submission. It's to get a shortlist of 800 is quite a difficult thing. So it's based on what we see in front of us. It's totally anonymous. We don't know the artist's name or where they're coming from or whatever, or what their other works have been like in the past. It's all done based on the piece in front of us.
So,
and it's great fun.
I would say, and lots of debate, I would guess, too. But what was the panel's initial reaction then when you saw the particular image that we're talking about here, Throwback Selfies Magdalene?
Well, my memory of it is that it got a very strong reaction from all six of us, and that we all said yes to having it in for the short list selection. Now, then the work comes through to the gallery. Then the artists bring their work in, and we look at it in the round, if you like. So it's not like going on a blind date. We can actually see what we're getting.
So the artist in question here, then, David Lester Mooney, mm-hmm. did he come in person with this image?
No. I don't believe he did. I think, as far as I understand, it was brought in by his printers.
All right. At what point did you realise that this image had been generated by artificial intelligence?
I didn't realise it until it had been accepted.
And your reaction at that point?
My reaction at that point was really intrigue and interest and you know, this is going to be probably something that will, you know, create a bit of discussion. Certainly, I didn't imagine it would be as the hullabaloo would be as great as it is now today on Twitter and such like. But yeah, I mean, this is the future, isn't it? AI is coming. We can't stop it. No matter who wants to protest against it, it's here.
And was there any discussion? Did the committee, you know, did it raise any kind of questions at all around the fact that it had been generated by AI? Was that a point of discussion among the committee?
We knew that it was some sort of a generated, computer generated image, but AI was not something that came up at the time.
And was there any discussion of then, you said that it was only the printers you think that came in with the particular mm-hmm. image. Was there any discussion of the technical process involved in generating the image?
By whom,
John? Did you discuss that with the artist or indeed with the printers or no. with anybody else?
No, we didn't, no.
And
I mean, what happens is the work comes into to us. If it gets a strong reaction, if we think it's a well-made piece of work, if it is an interesting piece of work, this one is particularly interesting, I think, because, as you say, it's a selfie, mm. or it appears to be a selfie. I mean, when you think about our women who were subjected to these laundries, they had no way of curating their lives. Today, if you want to take a selfie of yourself and put it out into the ether, you curate that yourself. These women had no power whatsoever over their lives. I think it's a really extraordinary image, and it brings back into our consciousness this whole thing of what we have done, what we did to women and children. Mm. It has to stay in our consciousness, and this is one way of doing it.
And the accusations then that have been made in and around bad taste, or that the subject matter has been treated irreverently in some way, what's your reaction to that?
Well, I certainly don't see it as irreverent. And I think the artist has taken something that is profoundly uncomfortable and is actually offering us up a way of looking at it in today's context in terms of how we as women can live our lives in great freedom.
And the other debate that has been, or argument that has been made, is around the whole anonymizing process, that this particular selfie, this AI-generated image, is another part of that anonymizing process. Do you agree with that?
In the sense that the people in it are anonymous?
Yes.
Yeah, sure, it's anonymous, yes.
So is that another example of an anonymizing of the women who suffered in the Magdalene laundries then? Or did that come up for discussion in any way, the subject matter?
The subject matter came up in terms of, yes, that they all looked quite similar. They have it's like an identikit image in a way. And that was important because I think if we look back into that history, The women had no names. Their names were taken away from them during that period. They were anonymous. Their families possibly didn't even know where they were.
Finally, then, I'm wondering just in terms of the artist, him or herself, because we're told that the artist's name is David Lester Mooney. Do you go about establishing the identity or the bona fides of these artists for the AI artist as much as for any of the other, for the traditional artists who are part of the exhibition?
No, we take it on good faith. For 200 years, we have been running an annual exhibition. I mean, we've had 193 of them now. And it's done on good faith. We stand by the work that's selected and the artists who are in the exhibition. And there's a real sense of community. This is, as an academy, we are artists for artists. So no, we're not going to go back into your background and check, well, if you painted cows today, did you paint cows yesterday, you know?
So you take it purely on the basis of the images in front of you. That's your criteria that's your major criterion for making the choices.
Exactly. And it's based on trust, I suppose, as well, you know.
Well, Abigail, go ahead. Did you want to say something just to finish?
No. I mean, just based on trust and respect as well. I mean, this artist has made a work that has created a lot of conversation. And isn't that a good thing? We have to have a big conversation now about AI, and different people will have different views. But we all have to be heard, and we all have to respect people's point of view.
Abigail, thanks so much for coming on to speak to us about all of that this evening. That's Abigail O'Brien, President of the RHA, and the exhibition continues through until July the 31st of this year. And you can find out full details of the wheres and the whys and the whens on the website, which is rhagallery.ie. Almost 2 years ago on the programme, I spoke with the poet and novelist Nick Laird about Up Late, an elegy he had written for his father, who had recently died. Now Nick publishes a poetry collection, his fifth with the same title, and that long poem is at the heart of this new work. Strong sense of loss is everywhere, in fact, in this new collection. So it too is a keen eye on the natural world and on all the frailties, follies and joys of the human world as well. Delighted that Nick Laird joins us once again on the programme this evening. Nick, I remember speaking to you. I remember reading Up Late and being stopped in my tracks when I read it back in 2021. It went on, in fact, to win the 2022 Forward Prize for Best Single Poem. Just remind us of the circumstances in which you wrote that central elegy, Up Late, when you wrote it in 2021.
Well, I think the same circumstances that applied to a lot of people who'd lost loved ones in COVID. I was talking to my dad and he was having a cough and it just got worse. And he'd been sitting in his living room really for a year waiting for the vaccine, and then he got it. And then he went to Lidl to go shopping, but he didn't wait long enough. He went 3 days after he got the vaccine, and then he got very sick, and then he was dead in 10 days. And whereas when my mother was dying, we were in the hospice with her really for the last week with my dad. We couldn't be there. So because I'm a poet, I just sat in my office in my garden and wrote, because I wasn't really fit company for anyone. So that's why the poem came about. It's got a weird real time element because of that. But just because, you know, you couldn't be there with the person who was dying.
I know we've covered some of this when we spoke the last time, but just dealing with the immediacy of that grief, you know, he gets sick, he gets a bit of a cough, goes into hospital. 10 days later, he's gone. You can't go to visit him. You have spoken to him on Zoom. There's a very helpful nurse, Elizabeth is the name you use in the poem, who's really wonderful in terms of trying to facilitate that communication. What did writing that central elegy do for you in terms of even touching on the grief that you must have experienced, Nick?
Well, it's hard to say exactly, but I think I talk about it in the poem a bit. It was a companionship of grief in a way. It was a way to sort of bind the grief in words, you know, that's sort of what an elegy is. And I do know it was sort of helpful to me to be doing something, to be thinking things through in a way. I don't know whether it's helpful 2 years later to be, you know, going on about it exactly.
Yeah.
At the time, it did feel kind of sort of central to what I was doing. I was trying, poetry's interested in trying to, you know, clarify, to try and work out what's happening. And I think it was partly to do with that. And, you know, he's my father. I wanted to honour him and, you know, write an elegy sort of sufficient to the moment.
Let us go to the very first poem then, in what is now the collection Up Late. So the elegy that you wrote that went on to, that we spoke about 2 years ago and that went on to win that Forward Prize for Best Single Poem, is part two of this three-section collection. It's the middle section, if you like. So there are two movements or two little collections on either side of it, whatever way you want to look at that. The very first poem in the collection is called Grief. Will you read that for us?
I will, yeah. Grief. In the jungle or dense forest, what can distance mean? Space, to the dweller there, is a successive net of places, cages ringed by living palings, lacking an overall structure. And the same is true of time. There are no seasons, no sky, nothing beyond day and night. Time, like space, is shallow. Neither past nor future holds substantial interest, but continue following the stream and you presumably will come to see.
That's Nick Laird reading his poem Grief from his new collection Up Late. To what extent, Nick, having written the elegy for your father, which was obviously a deeply personal act and had its own I don't like to use that word, cathartic, but had its own help way of helping you through that grief at that period. Did you find yourself moving out from that very personal, very specific poem, long poem, into a more, I suppose, a more general contemplation or poetic contemplation of grief?
Yes, I think, you know, time does its work. And a wee poem like that, it came about, I was reading a book by a Chinese guy about human geography, and he was talking about people who grew up in like the Amazon jungle. Their concepts of time and space were different, partly because everything was so up close. And as I was reading it, I was thinking, it's kind of like describing the totality of being in a space of grief. Like, you can't see very far ahead, and time and space are different. So it seemed to me like there was a wee kind of metaphor there that I wanted to try and push on. That's where that came about. But yeah, it certainly was written a bit further away from the event.
Yeah, and it has that feel to it, you know, the middle section. I really feel every time, and I reread it again ahead of our interview this evening, I felt that I was in the room with you, you know, literally. Well, you were at home in your study, you know.
Yeah,
I felt that I was that you really had brought me into a very intimate place. Is that a more frightening place for a poet to bring us than, say, in that poem Grief, which is quite existential, it's very philosophical, and it's beautifully expressed. Is there less at stake, if you like, in a poem of that more general nature?
Oh, it's a good question. I think there are lots of kinds of poetry. I think sometimes you want poetry that will bring you into an intimate space, but, you know, that's a hard thing too. And sometimes you want maybe a slightly more abstracted idea. I think poetry and philosophy do tend to come at the same ideas, you know, how to be, how to live. Philosophy seems to start with kind of generalizing abstractions and work down, and poetry begins with particulars and works up, but they both arrive at the same place. Mm. I think the poems kind of do the same work in a way, but it'd be hard, you know, to be dealing with poems like Up Late all the time. You know, it is sort of so emotional and so torturous.
Yeah. The other aspect, as you describe it there, about philosophy and poetry, I suppose, maybe arriving at the same place, but getting there in different ways. Philosophy will probably express it in prose in an awful lot more words than a poem will do, for sure. You have a little look at that. I don't know if it's a dig at the poetic profession, but certainly a little wry smile at what goes on in a poet's life. Maybe will you introduce the vocation for me and read it?
I will. Maybe poking a wee bit of fun at poets. But sure, we're fit for it. So it's called The Vocation. Shall I give it a read?
Yeah, sure. Do, please.
The Vocation. It's fair enough for a poet to have some dirt beneath his fingernails or a piece of leaf caught in her hair. When you ask him how he's doing, it's fine for him to shuffle up the bench a bit to let the ghost sit down, or for her to pull a tangled length of metaphor out of her pocket to tie together all the losses. It's more than normal for a poet to choose the window while the novelists prefer the aisle. When poets turn on each other, they are like milk turning. When they love, they are children with money. They think their desk is an altar, and wearing a black sweater speaks of perpetual mourning. That staring at the ceiling is an hour spent thinking how the mundane deserves its beautiful due. And in the wallet of the poets at the business cards they've printed up declaring on one side, the statement on the other side is true. And on the other side, the statement on the other side's a lie.
That's Nick Laird reading his poem, The Vocation. I love that. I love that, those final two little stanzas. The statement on the other side is true, and on the other side, the statement on the other side is a lie. I had to read it about 40 times.
I still don't understand it. It's called The Liar's Paradox, but it's too much for me.
Well, isn't it? It reminded me of that, you know, the old story about you're locked in a room and one person in the room with you always tells lies, and the other person always tells the truth. You've got one question and you've got to find the key. Who do you ask, and what question do you... One of them has the key, so who do you ask and what question do you... It reminded me of that. Do you remember that one, or is that just something from my past?
No, it is that. It's something, the answer is something like, if I asked the other person, would yeah. they? But I don't. Yeah.
Yeah. Exactly. So if you, no matter who you, if you ask the liar, he will say no. And if yeah. you ask the fellow who tells the truth, he'll tell you what the liar would say. So you'll find out where the key is. As a result, people can work that little one out for themselves as they go along. But I was interested. You are drawing comparisons, I suppose, between the writing of prose and the writing of poetry. There, do they form very different places in your life?
I think that's true. That the thing about the poets prefer the window seat, while novelists prefer the aisle. I think poets are more interested in, tend to be more interested in relationships between, you know, in the natural world, and novelists more interested in society and how people interact with each other. And I'm not writing, I'm not working on a novel at the minute. I've written a few, but poetry has sort of taken center stage of me for a few years. I've been teaching and thinking about it a lot, writing essays about it. So, yeah, they're different. They use different parts of your brain. It's nice to be able to do them both. I think you get to do the sort of run the full gamut. But poetry's special, you know.
Yeah, and you picked social media as your target in the poem Modest Proposal. It's kind of your response, if you like, to Jonathan Swift's original, one could say highly original, A Modest Proposal from 1729. Was that an obvious choice? Are we still battering on about the same old things? It's just that the tune is the same, but the words have changed slightly.
In terms of
social media, and in terms of what Swift was talking about in A Modest Proposal.
Yeah, well, I think that was a commemoration. Someone asked me to write something called A Modest Proposal, and I was thinking, what is something that we do that if you presented it in kind of, you know, if you describe some of the behavior modification that people have sort of willingly undergone due to, you know, having their phones on them and social media, they would look at you and say, you know, well, of course we're not going to do that. You know, they'd refuse it. But actually, we all do it, or other people did. I actually don't have a mobile phone, so I was working from the imagination. But yeah, so I think the poem seeks to describe some of the kind of deal with the devil that people have done now.
I'd like to finish with a poem, and it goes back to your father. I just love the little image that's in Night Sky in Tyrone, maybe because it's a neighbouring county to my own county of Monaghan. And this idea of the robin is a beautiful idea. Was that something that you grew up with, that the robin is possibly the soul of the dead person?
Not a robin exactly, but I'd always thought of birds being people come back. Yeah, I didn't know whether it was an Irish idea, whether people, maybe it was just a family idea. But we have a big night sky in Tyrone. We have the Dark Skies Observatory just outside Omagh. Yeah. So the sky is, you know, powdered with stars. It's something special.
It's nearly as good as the sky in Monaghan. So I'll let you go ahead with Night Sky in Tyrone. Nick, right, thanks very much.
Thank you. Night sky in Tyrone. Maybe birds provide the eyes the dead look out of. Or is it knots in furniture they queue up at to spy from, bickering, whispering with shock how grey her hair is now, how skinny he has got. My sister thinks that portly robin on the lawn is dad come back to say hello. And he takes a little hop out of sunlight into shade, before alighting on the compost bag and lengthily explaining everything that we can see is his apple tree, his grass, that patch of rhubarb he'd been about to cut back. Why not? We finish up a bottle, then another, and the evening's coming on, and then the night is here, and we sit out underneath so much made known that's always there, the depths of emptiness and fire.
That's Nick Laird reading his poem Night Sky in Tyrone from his latest collection Up Late, which is published by Faber. And Nick will be reading at Listowel's Writers' Week. He'll be reading alongside Paul Muldoon from County Armagh, so it's a real Ulster connection there. And that reading takes place on Friday, June the 2nd. White House Plumbers, the HBO series that starts on Sky this week, takes the audience behind the scenes of the Watergate scandal as Nixon's political saboteurs, Hunt and Liddy, accidentally topple the presidency they were supposed to be protecting. This satirical drama begins in 1971 when the White House hires Hunt and Liddy, former CIA and FBI respectively, to investigate the Pentagon Papers leak. After failing upward, the unlikely pair lands on the committee to re-elect the president, plotting several unbelievable covert ops, including bugging the Democratic National Committee offices at the Watergate complex. White House Plumber sheds lights on the lesser-known series of events that led up to one of America's greatest political crimes. Even as I read it, you know, you think, how on earth did that actually happen? Lee's Hand, I should say. Did I say that Lee's Hand is in the studio with me? Lee's Hand is in the studio with me to talk about this. Yeah. You kind of go, how on earth did that happen? You know,
yeah.
you're a total self-proclaimed Watergate junkie.
Yeah.
The plumbers, as they're called.
Yeah.
Is it kind of, how big an offshoot is it? How central is it to the story?
Well, it is quite central. I mean, there's a great scene in the Alan J. Pakula film of All the President's Men, where Robert Redford is meeting the Deep Throat in his source, you know, who's called Deep Throat, down in a basement and or in a car park. And he says, and Deep Throat says, forget the myths the media's created about the White House. The truth is, these are not very bright guys and things got out of hand. And that really is the premise for this. That's the sort of premise. This focuses on the two guys, one is ex-CIA, one is ex-FBI, and they're how they basically bungled, you know, their way into the sort of this, you know, this incredible scandal. And like, when you're watching it, you're going, that can't happen. I mean, you know, these guys were going into sort of, you know, the sort of the poobahs in you know, the committee to re-elect the president and going, yeah, you know, we think if we just hire like hookers and get loads of cocaine and stick them all on a yacht and get loads of Democratic, you know, bigwigs to come along and then we'll get, you know, blackmail on them. And, you know, that was eventually said, no, maybe that's just a little over the top. But, you know, these guys and their team, they were called the plumbers because it was We Fix Leaks and they were all the dirty tricks. But like Gordon Liddy wanted to actually call them something like, you know, Black Ops or something. I mean, like, talk about, you know, nailing your colours to the mast.
Yeah.
And, you know, but these people did do insane things, like they sort of, you know, bombed the offices of the psychiatrist of Daniel Ellsberg, who was the guy who released the Pentagon Papers in the hopes of getting his psychiatric file and discrediting him. You know, this was sort of mad. And the actual, when they were nabbed on the night of the 17th of June 1972 for the burglaries, when, you know, when the five burglars were arrested, now it wasn't Hunt and Liddy among them, this was their fourth attempt. Like, yeah. You know, they had actually cocked up the other three, do you know? So, you know, I was very excited when I saw this because, you know, I mean,
but just on Hunt and Liddy,
yeah.
Like, were they really stupid guys?
Well, no,
were they just dealing in a very peculiar world?
Well, they were a bit bonkers. Yeah, I mean, they were. But, you know, this is also sort of a time coming out of the Cold War where paranoia was rampant.
Right, yeah.
And Hunt had been involved in the Bay of Pigs, which, of course, was the disastrous, you know, attempt to invade Cuba in the 60s. But they were kind of crazy. I mean, Gordon Liddy was well known for being crazy. I mean, he used to have this party trick where he'd put his hand over a flame and hold it there and people would be freaking out. And he'd say the trick is...
Frank O'Connor, did he?
Yeah, well, he would say the trick is not caring. So, you know, and this guy was completely mad. And he is played, I mean, the two main characters which are played, you know, Hunt and Liddy are played by Woody Harrelson and Justin Theroux, and it's massive sort of you know, scenery chewing going on. I mean, they really are. And I mean, particularly Theroux is actually really good. I mean, he's kind of like an evil Ron Burgundy almost. Like, you just never know what he's going to do. And you know, but the thing about the problem with this is it's billed as a satire, but it's kind of a hectic brew of satire, slapstick, caper movie, buddy movie, true crime, family soap opera, conspiracy theories and political commentary all
in one go
over five series. And that's, I think, is slightly
over
the problem.
The five episodes makes up the series. Let's have a listen to a clip, which is where Hunt, the Woody Harrelson character, meets Liddy, the Justin Theroux character, for the first time. There's a bit of confusion as to who's going to be in charge here. But alongside them is a character called Croc. Is that how we say his name? Played by Richard Summer.
Evil Crow.
Yeah, so Crow.
Croc or Croc. It depends what part of Ireland you're from, I suppose.
Fair enough. Well, here's the introductory moment and the little battle between the two.
Gordon Liddy, this is Howard Hunt.
Oh, also made you sound like a regular James Bond.
Money. He never mentioned you. For the record, James Bond is a work of fiction. I am the real deal. I write fiction, so I know the difference.
Howard and Coulson are both brown men.
Oh.
Where do you go to school, amigo?
Fordham.
They teach you that pencil business at Fordham?
We're told Ellsberg is seeing a psychiatrist.
But I had a few ideas about Ellsberg. You know, I think he might be...
There's been a spate of rapes in the area. So I've been teaching the girls in the office a little basic self-defense.
Well, let us pray those rapes happen near pencil sharpeners.
Gentlemen.
See, Hunt, here at SIU I try and teach my people to embrace the unorthodox. Dream the impossible.
Your people? But, maybe I'm a little confused here. Coulson told me that SIU is my op, with you providing oversight, of course.
You have been given erroneous information. SIU is mine. Everybody knows SIU is a Gordon Liddy operation.
Gentlemen, as per the president, I will be heading up SIU. You two will work together. You will report to me. That's the arrangement. Take it or leave it.
Roger, then.
That's Richard Summer as the Crow character, whichever it is. Woody Harrelson as Howard Hunt and Justin Theroux as Gordon Liddy. This is from the HBO series White House Plumber, starts on Sky tonight, and Lisa Hand has been watching it for us. It is quite talky, even in that it's quite dense, that clip, you know, and I think a lot of the material that I've listened to and seen online is quite dense, Lise.
It is quite dense. I mean, you know, you would know the writers worked on things like sort of Veep and Seinfeld, and, you know, it has that a lot of talking. And of course, it's loads of men talking because, I mean, it's just reflecting politics as is.
Yeah.
There's very few, but I have to say, the show's almost stolen. I think, personally.
Lena Headley as Hunt's wife, is it?
Oh, yeah. I mean, who plays Dorothy Hunt? I mean, she's just absolutely, she's just so good. Because it's like, you know, it is a man's world, you know, and, you know, she kind of just when the brown stuff hits the fan, you know, she just rolls up her sleeves and kind of just, you know, gets stuck in. And
Donald Gleeson is in there as well, isn't
and
he?
And Donald Gleeson, like he plays John Dean, who's the sort of the very treacherous White House counsel. And also Kathleen Turner turns up as Dieter Beard. And again, just sort of scenery chewing stuff. So it's like the buddy stuff is actually quite interesting because it does, the whole thing starts off incredibly manic and really frantic, and it does have that sort of satire thing, but it gets sort of slower and darker. By episode five, it's quite different from where it started in episode one.
And how much do you need to go into this with a lot of Watergate knowledge in your head, or do you get lots of exposition explaining if you're lost?
Actually, no. You would need probably to have some kind of knowledge about what went on. I mean, there are things like references to, you know, Bay of Pigs and, you know, CREEP, CRP, the Committee to Re-elect the President, who they were the kind of guys who set all this in motion. But you would probably have to have a bit of background. I mean, you know, I would say if you want to kind of, you know, go back to the source, read All the President's Men, watch the amazing movie, listen to the fantastic podcast Slow Burn on Watergate, which
that's
is absolutely
your kind
amazing.
Of prep for it.
Yeah, I mean, like, then if you really want to know about it, like, it's absolutely fantastic. But look, it's great. And I mean, as I said, just to watch Gordon Liddy, I mean, there's some absolutely laugh out loud moments. There's a dinner party scene that, you know, this is a guy who relaxes listening to the Nuremberg rallies of like Adolf Hitler and stuff like that. And, you know, it's that's a bit, one of the sort of more black satire bits. But, you know, it is definitely worth a watch.
Worth the watch, and the five episodes could have been done quicker.
You know what? If they had, I think they would have ended up with like an Hernando Iannucci kind of classic if they just cut it down, you know, it just could have been sharper. I think they probably could have done it in three.
All right, less is always more, isn't it?
Sometimes it is.
Okay, that's Lise Hand speaking to us about White House Plumbers. It begins at 9 p.m. this evening on Sky Atlantic. Now, in a moment, I'll be talking to a very successful young flautist, Rachel Nolan, and her teacher, Rhianna O'Donin. First of all, let's listen to a version of the concerto that Rachel will be playing with the National Symphony Orchestra tomorrow night. This is the second movement, or part of the second movement, of Carl Nielsen's Flute Concerto. And the soloist here is Emmanuel Pahud. A little section there of the opening of the second movement from Carl Nielsen's Flute Concerto. Emmanuel Pahud was the soloist there. But that is the concerto that will be being played tomorrow night in the National Concert Hall. I suppose for most classical music students, the chance to perform with an orchestra is definitely a career dream. But to perform with the National Symphony Orchestra must rank up there at the very brilliant parts of a dream for the start of a career. And that is, dream is coming through for a number of students at the Royal Irish Academy of Music. This project is called Concerto Project. And tomorrow evening, four of the Academy's most exciting emerging student artists will make their concerto debuts with the National Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Gavin Maloney, all in the National Concert Hall. One of those four students is flautist Rachel Nolan, who will be performing all of the concerto from which we just heard a minute with the National Symphony Orchestra tomorrow night. And also in studio with us this evening is her teacher and, by coincidence, I guess, the National Symphony Orchestra's Flute Associate Principal, Rhianna O'Donin. Both very welcome. And also Edward Holly, who's here, going to do a little bit of keyboard playing for us along the way. First of all, congratulations to you, Rachel.
Thank you.
When did you hear that you were going to be doing this concerto tomorrow night in the National Concert Hall with the National Symphony Orchestra?
Well, it was on the night of the final for the competition, so they sort of just called out all our names, so it was a bit surreal to hear my name called out for that.
So there was quite a process getting to that point, was there?
Yeah, so there was two rounds, so a number of students went for the first round, and then eight people got picked to go into the final, so then we all played our full concertos, and then four of us got picked from there, so... It was, yeah, a tough process.
And hearing on that night, because what stage are you at in your studies now?
I just finished my undergrad in music education, so I'm doing a recital artist diploma in the Royal Irish Academy at the moment, and then next year I'll be in Utrecht studying for a master's in flute performance.
So in actual performance itself. And for you, Rhian, I often wonder, Rhian, if for the teacher of a student of Rachel's calibre, and I mean, I'm sure there are others in there who are equally talented or who have lots of things going for them as well. For a teacher in those type of situations, yeah, you know, how nervous are you for your students in those competition situations?
Yeah, I suppose you feel every note that they're playing, especially if you're familiar with the piece yourself. Mm. So there are definitely nerves there. But I know in the case of Rachel, she was so well prepared for all of the various stages. She's extremely well prepared for tomorrow. She's a hard worker.
She had a very good teacher, had she?
She I can't take full credit because she also takes lessons from Bill Dowdall at the Academy.
All
so
right.
We've both been teaching her for the last couple of years. So, yeah, I definitely can't take all the credit. But no, she's. We had the rehearsal earlier today with the orchestra and Gavin Maloney conducting, and she sounds fantastic. So,
Were you sitting playing in the orchestra?
Believe it or not, there are no flutes in the orchestra part of the Nielsen Concerto. So. Which was lovely because I could sit in the audience and have a listen for balance and have a listen to the overall effect. So it's great. There, whatever nerves there were beforehand after the rehearsal this afternoon, I think I've full confidence in her, and it really sounds lovely.
Is that usual for, you know, the concerto, the instrument that is the concerto soloist, for that instrument to be lost,
left out of
the orchestra?
Not necessarily. It depends. It depends on the composer. In this case, I suppose it is unusual. This piece is unusual in that it's kind of almost like chamber music. There are very unusual sections in it in that there's a bass trombone solo, which features heavily with the flute, like a duet that they have together.
Bass, trombone and flute?
Yes.
Don't sound like happy bedfellows, but clearly they are in Carl Nielsen's mind.
It sounds great in this piece, I can tell you. And there's also a very heavy clarinet part. So there's lots of interplay between clarinet and flute. There's a viola solo in there as well, I think. Yeah. And so in this case, the flutist soloist is plenty in this piece, I can tell you.
Plenty to be doing, I would have thought. Where does it sit in terms of, you know, when you're working through the repertoire at the early stages of your career, which, you know, you're emerging at this stage, really, Rachel, where does the Carl Nielsen Flute Concerto sit? Is it, you know, is it the elephant in the room for 4 or 5 years before you get to it? Is it a huge piece that you just have to reckon with at some point?
Yeah, I sort of put it off for a few years, but I'm glad I sort of tackled it now. It was definitely difficult, but I've sort of grown to love it and just tackling the harder bits. But it's really come together, and it was so great to hear with the orchestra earlier. It was really surreal to have like the National Symphony Orchestra behind me, which is an orchestra I sort of aspire to be a part of one day. So it's just a great experience altogether.
And Raina is saying there that, you know, that part of the situation here is that it's like chamber music.
Yeah.
And when I hear that term chamber music, you know, if you're playing in the body of the orchestra, you have a bit of support around you. Even if you're an orchestra player and there's a solo and you kind of have your whatever, 8, 12, 25 bars where you're by yourself, at least you have the people beside you maybe shuffling their feet to say, go for it, you did well, that's great, and kind of, or if it goes wrong, giving you a compassionate pat on the back. But in chamber style pieces like this, you're exposed and you're the soloist out the front.
Yeah, it's very...
I don't want to make it more nervous than you need to be for tomorrow night. But I guess that's part of it. Part of this process is not just learning the notes and how to play it. It's dealing with that pressure.
Yeah. It was very... like, it's good to have the rehearsal today and we have another run through tomorrow just to sort of, you know, sort of feel which bits I'm more exposed for. Because, you know, listening to recordings, like I have like the flute in the background sort of supporting me, but it's me on my own in this case tomorrow. So but it was good, like I've listened to it a lot and studied the score and stuff, which really helps.
And you're saying listening to recordings, we happen to play Emmanuel Pahu. Do you have favourite recordings of this concerto, and who have you been listening to that
literally every recording I could find. A lot, they're all very different. I really like Pahu's recording, he's probably one of my favourite ones. He's definitely my go-to flute player for recordings, but I've just listened to everything I could find. There's a Carl Nielsen competition, so there's lots of recordings that come out of that, which is great for research and to listen to it.
And the Carl Nielsen competition, did you say? Didn't you win 2 competitions on the night of the finals that you were talking about earlier on?
Yeah, so there was the Maura Dowdall competition happening at the same time. So it's from the Dowdall family. So I won the highest woman in brass place, which is donated by the Dowdall family, which was the Brian Dunning Awards. So it was dedicated in memory of him, which is a really great award to win. But yeah, I was delighted to win it.
Now, as if it wasn't enough to be put up in front of the orchestra today and to be onto the National Concert Hall stage tomorrow night, you're going to play a little solo for me live on air this evening as well. You're going to give us a section from a piece here. What is this piece, Rachel, first of all?
So this is a piece by an Irish composer named John Buckley. And it's one of his 2 fantasias for alto flute, but I'm just going to play it on my C flute today.
So the alto flute would be a bit longer and
a bit bigger,
and deeper.
Yeah. Deeper, exactly, yeah. So I'm just going to play it on C flute today. Yeah. Just a little short section of it.
Absolutely beautiful. You don't get much more exposed than that. Just you by yourself. That's Rachel Nolan, who is one of the Royal Irish Academy music students who will be playing in the concerto project tomorrow night in the concert hall. And before we wrap, because I know you're going to play a little duet for me as well, Raina, who are the other 3 students and what instruments are involved in the other performances tomorrow night?
The other ones are, there's a soprano called Lauren McCann, and then there's a mezzo soprano called Emma Power, and then we have a pianist, Kale Pereira. And so it's 4 of them in total and a range of different concertos. So it promises to be a really entertaining evening music.
And I'm sure you have been mentoring Rachel all along the way. But for that big moment tomorrow night, what's the secret to gathering those nerves and not letting them overtake you?
I suppose just to, I always say, don't play too much in the day. You've had your big rehearsal today. There will be a run through tomorrow. Play as little as possible. It's hard to fight the urge of practice. I have the whole day until 8 o'clock. I must practice, lots and lots of practice. Yeah. Don't do it.
If you don't know it now, you're not going to know
exactly
it at 8 o'clock
right.
this evening.
Exactly. So sometimes we talk about breathing exercises beforehand. She's on first, which I think is a great thing, because there's less hanging around.
Yeah.
But I think I have nothing to worry about in this case. I think she feels comfortable with how everything's going. So we're just looking forward to it at this point.
Yeah. Congratulations once again, Rachel. Best of luck tomorrow night. Hope it goes very well for you and indeed the others as well. What is the little duet then that you're going to play for us? Maybe Raina, you tell us this.
It's a piece by Franz Doppler. It's called Andante e Rondo, and it's a section from the Rondo that we're going to play, the faster section. Doppler was a Hungarian composer and a virtuosic flute player himself, and he wrote this for himself and his brother, who was also a flute player. So,
two flute players in the family.
Two flutes, I know.
Competition.
I'm like trouble.
Yeah. Okay, let's have a listen. And as I say, it's Edward Holly will be accompanying on keyboard. Every Tuesday night, please. That was Raina O'Donine and her pupil Rachel Nolan there on the two flutes, accompanied by Edward Holly on piano, on keyboard there, with the Rondo movement from the Andante et Rondo of Franz Doppler, Opus 25. And the concerto, the Royal Irish Academy of Music concerto concert tomorrow night, Wednesday the 31st of May, National Concert Hall. Now, the news was announced today that the visual artist Graham Nuttall died at the weekend. He was 69 years old, very well known for his bold use of colour and distinctive figures, trained at the fine art at the Leary College of Art and Design, and characterised his own work as being theatrical. Let's hear from him now. In 1994, he spoke to RTE's Colm Connolly about the people who collect him and his use of colour.
I was doing a lot of work for people in Hollywood. I was doing work for Sylvester Stallone, for quite a few of them, producers, Elizabeth Taylor's Vet, even bought a picture of it. I found them very, very pushy and very, they were said to be contracts in the post for looking for territories for different areas and this sort of thing. And I had three calls from Sylvester Stallone one day trying to dictate what I was painting, what I was to put into my paintings. And I felt that they were trying to turn me into a bit of Hollywood. And so I thought it's better just stay in Ireland, let Hollywood come to me. I think people's perception of colour is changing, and people, because of television and films and graphics and modern printing methods, I think people need stronger colours in order for your message to get through to them.
Is there a painting you still have to paint that you feel you've got to do someday?
Oh, yeah. You see, I think when an artist paints a picture, when he's finished it, all he really sees is the faults. There's always a perfect picture to paint, but I don't think anyone will ever do it.
Graham Nuttall, artist there, speaking to RTE's Colm Connolly in 1994. Graham Nuttall died on Saturday at the age of 69.